Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Jobs numbers come out tomorrow, and maybe, just maybe, you'll want to take them with even more salt than usual. We introduce you to one of the world's biggest companies you've never heard of, and we wrap up our series on the secret life of food stamps. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, April 3rd. Well, this is a big week for economists. Tomorrow, unemployment figures from the federal government. And on top of that, a whole nother set of unemployment figures from a company called ADP. That's a payroll processor. Well, it turns out those ADP numbers have been different from the government's lately. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
Economists can be a tough crowd. One even called ADP's latest numbers a late April fool's joke. Ouch. It has had some hits and misses. For example, ADP estimated 130,000 jobs were created last October. The actual number, 212,000.
You know, it's a bit of a stretch.
That's Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi economist Christopher Rupke. He says ADP markets its numbers as a highly accurate predictor of job creation, but he says they're not. Sofia Koroketsky is an economist at Moody's, which works with ADP to come up with the jobs numbers, which are based on payroll figures and federal data. She says ADP isn't that far off.
Every month we're a little above or below, but on average, we're almost right on.
Koroketsky acknowledges that they've tinkered with the formula used to come up with the ADP jobs number, adding information from the Philadelphia Federal Reserve. But she says, look, there are millions of jobs in this country, and their figure may be off by tens of thousands. To which Rupke says,
it's bad, yes, because we need it tighter than that.
But even Rupke says it's impossible to predict these job numbers perfectly, and he does use the ADP numbers in his economic forecasts, as do many other economists, like Jim O'Sullivan of High Frequency Economics.
It's one more indicator to watch.
O'Sullivan says the ADP numbers are just one tool in his toolbox. Not perfect, but very helpful when used with his other economic forecasting tools. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
If you've overdrawn your checking account recently, I'm not going to judge, you may have noticed a jump in the penalty you've got to pay. Well, a recent study says the median overdraft charge hit a record $30 last year. The government has made it harder for banks to charge those fees. You have to opt in to so-called overdraft plans, those that will let you for a fee buy, say, a $4 latte with your debit card, even if you only have $2 in your account. From WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott explains.
Bankers really miss all those fees they used to collect. Since the rules changed 4 years ago, Richard Hunt with the Consumer Bankers Association says only around 17% of customers opt in to overdraft plans. Then there's another new law limiting how much banks can charge merchants for debit card swipes.
Think about if McDonald's was told they can charge 50 cents for their $1 hamburger, they would probably charge more for their Coke.
But while banks are charging more, the money they're taking in from overdrafts is actually flat, about $32 billion last year. That's according to research firm Mebs Services. Economist Michael Mebs says people are more careful not to spend what they don't have.
The household, the family, is still hurting economically. And because of that, they've gotten much more shrewd in managing their checking accounts.
Consumer advocates say rising fees could push more people out of the banking system. Susan Weinstock directs the Safe Checking Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts.
We want to keep them in the banking system so that they can save money and pay their bills and have money that's safely in a place that isn't subject to being lost or stolen.
Despite better protections, Weinstock says there's still a lot of confusion out there. She says in a Pew survey, more than half of people who'd paid overdraft fees didn't think they had opted in. She expects the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to propose new rules as soon as this year. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, let's just say we won't be playing the happy music. Some details when we do the numbers. This This week on our show, we've followed the flow of federal food stamp dollars through the economy. We've been taking a look at the ripple effects. The food stamp program was written into law 50 years ago, but more people now are on food stamps than ever before, a record 1 in 7 Americans. We started at the beginning with low-income Americans when they get their benefits. Then we looked at what those food stamp dollars mean for hundreds of thousands of stores and at how employees at many of those stores, including full-time workers, rely on food stamps themselves. Marketplace's wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark's been reporting the story, and she joins us now. Hi, Chrissy.
Hey, David.
Your stories have generated a lot of listener response, a lot of comments, and one that came in pretty early on was just, should we be shocked by this, by the way this system works?
Yeah, and my point isn't at all to decide if you or any of the listeners should be shocked by this. My point was more just to say, hey, guys, let's actually look at what's really going on about how food stamps function as a part of our economic system in all these different ways. And maybe that will help us have more informed conversations about things like food stamp funding, about debates around the minimum wage. Let's just look at it and all get on the same page about it.
Your stories focus a lot on Walmart, and I wonder why that is. Why did you choose to focus on Walmart?
Well, Walmart is kind of hard to avoid when you're talking about things like food stamps and wages, just because they are so big. They are the largest employer in America. They're the largest recipient of food stamp dollars, and they're the largest retailer, full stop, in America. Mm. And because they've been such a successful company, they've really set the tone in a lot of ways for the competition. And I actually want to give Walmart a lot of credit for being very open to talk about this stuff. They invited me down to their headquarters in Arkansas. They really engaged in the issue. Other retailers that we reached out to, they all declined to be interviewed for this story. But I think that the role that Walmart plays in the economy, especially for low-income families, is a really interesting one. And it's kind of encapsulated in this phrase that I kept hearing at Walmart headquarters. I think it sort of gets to the heart of the paradoxes of the food stamp economy in America in a lot of ways.
I'll explain that. Tell us a bit more about those paradoxes.
So let me tell you the story. So I was at the Walmart headquarters in Arkansas, and I was at the visitor center there. And all of the tiles in the visitor center, which was actually Sam Walton's old, one of his first shops, right? The founder of Walmart, one of the very first stores he opened, all of the tiles were mismatched. And Alan Drano, who directs the visitor center, pointed them out to me and explained.
It's because Sam got a good deal on the tiles from the contractor. Yeah, true story. So I pointed that as our very first example of EDLC, which is everyday low cost, which is how we get to EDLP, which is everyday low prices, which is our strategy, our pricing strategy.
And that equation, that phrase EDLC leads to EDLP, everyday low costs lead to everyday low prices, is this driving philosophy at Walmart. I heard it multiple times when I was at the headquarters. And you can look at the equation in two different ways. When I talk to Carrie Denniston of the Walmart Foundation, she sees this as one of the key ways that Walmart helps America, really helps low-income Americans.
One of the greatest assets that we provide to local communities is often being there and being a grocer that can bring safe, affordable, nutritious products into areas that may not even have had access to them before.
But of course, remember that equation. To get to those everyday low prices, you need everyday low costs. And one of those costs is the cost of labor.
Some people would argue, and indeed we've seen them argue this in the comment section on the website, that Walmart could just raise wages, and I wonder why they haven't done that, why they've decided not to.
Right. Well, there's a couple things. I mean, Walmart is a business. They have the reasons why they think their approach is the best thing for their bottom line and their shareholders, which is ultimately what they're doing.
It's worried about its margins.
Right. Exactly. And then there are also questions about, well, if you raised wages, would that increase prices and by how much? And then would you be hurting low-income Americans in a different way? And we actually have a video that we've sort of gamed out some of these questions on our website. But there's also this other point that an economist at UC Irvine named David Newmark brings up. He's on the relatively conservative side of the spectrum. And he says it's not like food stamps are making Walmart and other companies pay low wages. They're going to pay low wages one way or the other. And so if low wages are part of the service economy right now, and if this is the economy we have, maybe food stamps coming in to make up the difference is a good system for low-wage workers.
I wish they were more skilled and were worth more in the labor market, but assuming that's not going to happen in the near future, I'd certainly rather they get those benefits than not get them. And I don't know that, personally, as an economist, don't have a strong feeling about somehow there's a moral obligation for them to sort of earn that from their work, or for employers to make sure they earn that from their work.
So he's talking about the near future and the economy that we have right now, and I wonder where that leaves us. Are things going to change? How would they change?
Well, the one thing that sort of everybody I talk to, from Walmart to some of the low-paid workers who are on food stamps, what they all said is we would love a world in which the food stamp program did not need to exist, especially for people who are able-bodied and who are working. But the question is, how do we get there? How do we kind of kickstart the economy so that businesses aren't getting pressured into raising their wages higher, but that they need to, because there's a lot of people with a lot of skills who can ask a lot for the work that they're doing.
You can find all of Chrissy's reporting on our website. That's at marketplace.org. Chrissy Clark, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You can check out our interactive called Wage Wager. That's also at marketplace.org. How many times have you gone online to look up a restaurant or a business, read a review, and wondered, is this accurate? Or maybe, who wrote this? Could it have been written by a competitor? Well, a carpet cleaner in Virginia is convinced that negative comments about his business posted on Yelp were both false and malicious, and he's decided to sue Yelp to find out who's behind those anonymous reviews. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
A review on Yelp incorrectly said that Joe Hadid's company had gone out of business. He says that review and others were malicious.
As a direct result of those negative reviews, our business saw a direct negative effect.
Hadid says he's had to lay off employees, so he's going to the Virginia Supreme Court to unmask those anonymous reviewers of his carpet cleaning business. But Professor Eric Goldman at Santa Clara University's law school says the Virginia law is unusual.
In the rest of the country, we've seen judges recognize the potential abuses that might occur if businesses have too easy access to the identity of anonymous or pseudonymous reviewers.
For example, an employee might want anonymity if he writes a negative review of his own employer.
Once the author is unmasked, that employee is going to get fired.
Accuracy is crucial for Yelp. Company spokesman Vince Salido says anonymous posts get too much attention.
The bulk of the reviews on Yelp are not anonymous. And in fact, that's what makes the service so useful.
Salido says Yelp vets the reviews.
We actually use an algorithm to recommend the most valuable and reliable content. So Yelp only recommends about 75% of the content it receives.
If a business owner suspects a competitor wrote a negative review, law professor Goldman recommends contacting the website. It doesn't always work, but he says it's better than going to court, where the negative message will get reinforced in public. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, a look at the world's biggest private security force.
G4S is a $12 billion a year business.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave up less than a point, closing flat at 16,572. The NASDAQ fell 38 points, 0.9%, ending at 4,237. And the S&P 500 slipped 2 points, 0.1%, finishing at 1,888. Liberty Media once really, really wanted to buy Barnes & Noble, and now it really, really doesn't want to. Liberty unloaded most of its big stake in the bookseller, and Liberty shares fell 2%. Shares of Barnes & Noble really, really fell 13%. European markets were mixed. Germany's DAX rose 0.2%. France's CAC 40 added 0.4%. Britain's FTSE slipped 0.1%. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.80%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. The Labor Department will release the March jobs report with the latest unemployment numbers. And since leaving his job, former President George W. Bush has become quite the artist. He'll debut 24 portraits he painted of world leaders on the Today Show. And it's the 50th anniversary of the day the Beatles became the first and only artists in history to snag the top five spots on the Billboard Hot 100. I'm Tommy Andres.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdal. Healthcare is changing. The definition of the word is taking on new meaning. At a time when everyone is trying to drive costs down, it's no longer enough for doctors to treat someone who's sick. Another goal is to keep individuals healthy. And that means, for at least some patients, that what happens in their homes or neighborhoods may be more important than anything that happens inside a hospital. Case in point, Camden, New Jersey, where Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein's been reporting his series Diagnosis Camden. From the health desk at WHYY, here's Dan.
We were all trying to breathe through our mouths.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Despite his obvious pain, 45-year-old Mariano Garcia sat transfixed, watching his podiatrist. Dr. David Malilli cut through the bandages wrapped around Garcia's left calf. It was one of those moments that takes forever. The smell filling the room.
Oh, God, yo.
The dressings came off. The room went quiet. Then Garcia gagged, and Malilli threw up his hands.
I don't have access to treat this, right? I mean, he's created a gram-negative infection here. I don't see any maggots or anything, but I'm not down with this. When's the last time the bandages were changed?
It was last time I was here.
Really? A week.
Garcia's been coming to Cooper University Hospital in Camden, New Jersey for 2 years now. And everybody in the room knows what needs to happen. Those bandages must get changed. But no matter how simple it sounds, it's not happening. Garcia, who's on disability, says it hurts him too much to do it. Visiting nurses say they don't feel safe going to his neighborhood. Frustrated and defeated, Malilli has one choice right now, but he knows sending Garcia to the hospital is just a temporary fix.
When we finally get things turned in the right direction again, how do we keep it that way? That 3 weeks after he leaves the hospital, you know, why are we not in the same situation? I can't control infection, I can't control pain, and I can't control these wounds.
Of course, doctors have never had much control over their patients outside the four walls of the hospital, which has been good for business.
In some ways, this is a system that's financially benefited the most when we're at our sickest.
Rebecca Oney runs the nonprofit Health Leads, which works with medical providers to connect patients to social services. In this new era where hospitals either drive down costs or face stiff financial penalties, Oney says the loop patients like Garcia are stuck in is no longer lucrative. Really, this is the edge of the healthcare world.
They're going to have to begin paying for a set of things that have historically been considered outside the scope of traditional healthcare.
We're beginning to see healthcare's first hesitant steps where doctors and hospitals begin to explore their patients' social needs. Kaiser Permanente, one of the top health systems, has several pilot programs, including one in Oregon where ambulance staff act more like social workers, helping solve problems at home, avoiding trips to the ER. Even the nation's largest healthcare program for the poor, Medicaid, has signaled its willingness to pay for some care outside the traditional stuff, like air conditioners for asthmatics. Stephen Cha is Medicaid's top doc.
We recognize that it can't just be the office visit. That's the core of it. But we have to think about when we face a patient, we're looking at much more than just what we can do in that 15-minute span.
Yale public health professor Elizabeth Bradley says it's no mystery that education, poverty, and safety have more to do with a person's overall health than medical care. And that, she says, makes our country's decision to spend 55 cents on social services for every dollar we spend on medical care curious. In a recent book, Bradley and her co-author found European countries that flip that ratio are healthier than we are.
The major reason that we are not doing better, and really the unnamed culprit, is that we are probably spending less on the social services than is necessary.
On this new healthcare frontier, we aren't seeing insurers paying for job training or hospitals move families out of dangerous neighborhoods. But if the interventions save money, the game changes. Harvard health economist Amitabh Chandra, though, has his doubts. He says, sure, this work improves health, but you only save money if hospitals can pinpoint which patients truly benefit. A tall order.
I think of that as analogous to the manned mission to Mars. It's something that can be done. There's no theorem in economics or statistics that says it's not possible. But you need absolutely terrific data to be able to make that happen. And I've just never seen it.
Chandra's driving at the X factor, so often at the crux of healthcare. What makes someone change their behavior? Which brings us back to Mariano Garcia in Camden.
I didn't ask for this. You know, I wish I could get better and get all this clear and get me a job and work, you know?
Garcia's life is so precarious, his options are risky. Like if he lands a spot in some inpatient treatment program for his leg, he's not sure what happens to his one-room apartment.
I don't want to lose my place because I'm going to hospital. Then where I'm going to go at? To find an apartment here in Camden, man, it's like, it took me like a year just to get one apartment.
There's no easy answer, which is what makes waiting outside the world of medical care tricky. But hospital staff addressing Garcia's social needs has helped him keep appointments and even once or twice change his own bandages. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We talked earlier in the show about Walmart, the largest private employer in the world. Let's now talk about the company that comes in at number three, and I'm guessing it's probably not one you've heard of. It's called G4S. G4S is based in London, and it's the largest private security company in the world, with 620,000 employees in 120 countries. Now, some of them provide security at banks and shopping malls, but a growing segment of the business is hiring and sending ex-military to places where government forces can't or won't go. William Longavisha is the international correspondent for Vanity Fair who traveled to see G4S at work in South Sudan. And William, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Give me some sense, if you would, about the size and the scale of this industry.
Well, it's very difficult to know because, for instance, in Brazil, estimates are that half of private security in Brazil is unlicensed, and much of that unlicensed half is armed. So the numbers aren't there. We just don't know. The estimates, very large estimates, are that private security globally account for about $200 billion of revenue in revenue per year now, and it's growing rapidly. G4S is a $12 billion a year business.
I wonder who would have done these jobs in the past. So you spend time with people who are doing demining work. Are these jobs that would have been done by state actors in the past or just wouldn't have been done, period? In other words, sort of are they filling a void here that's been left by these states?
Well, generally, they would have been done by militaries in the past, although whether a military would ever have wanted to intervene in a place like South Sudan is an open question. So it's the type of job is certainly a military job. These are all military specialists, highly, highly professional technically, and that is a military skill. But going into a place like South Sudan and many of these places where they are, I think militaries in the past have not done it and so probably would not have done it.
I should ask, these guys are being hired to go into South Sudan. Who's paying them to go there?
In this case, it's the UN. It's part of the large UN presence in South Sudan, the so-called peacekeeping effort, or that, what they really call it is they call it capacity building, which is the latest lingo for nation building.
What's the relationship like on the ground between G4S employees and, say, UN peacekeepers or the military in these countries?
Well, I know, and of course, in Iraq, it was a very tough relationship, and the U.S. military largely resented the presence of the private security details, and they belittled them for amateurism. I think in the case of Iraq, a lot of that was justified, the amateurish side. I didn't see any of that in G4S operations today. I saw quite a bit of respect, with the standard tensions about, you know, these people are incompetent or some guy's an idiot, that sort of thing. You always hear that.
This is a company that's also sort of lost control on a number of occasions, that it's indeed grown so big that it's hard to keep a handle on all of these outposts around the world.
There's no doubt that that's a problem for G4S, as it would be for any company of that size. So, yes, of course they have problems, and they're an easy target because they are a private force. And this goes against the conventional grain where these are either police or military functions that are, I mean, in an ideal world, would be performed by a public force. But you have to compare that to the riots, the killings, the brutality done by armies and by police forces. So, you know, the critics, I'm not here to defend G4S, to try to look at it honestly. And so the critics of a company like G4S who scream private security, it's unethical, it should be done by public forces, might take a careful look at what public forces have actually done.
William Longavisha is the international correspondent for Vanity Fair. He writes about G4S in his latest article, The Chaos Company. William, thanks very much for taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, a changing of the guard is in the works at the Ed Sullivan Theater. David Letterman said 2015 will be his last year as the host of The Late Show with David Letterman on CBS. So just a year or so more of those stupid pet tricks, of trips to see Rupert G. at the Hello Deli, and of that playful banter with Paul, his piano-playing sidekick. No word yet who will replace Letterman, and you gotta wonder, maybe Jay is interested. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. The Dow gave up less than a point. The NASDAQ fell 38 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 slipped 2 points, 0.1%. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm David Gura. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.